soon lost among dozens of other choppers flitting about the skyline. Then, it was relatively quiet again. Durand dropped the go-bag onto a nearby patio table, while Frey approached a second impressive bar done in the style of an ornate Buddhist stupa in direct contrast to the modernity of the surrounding penthouse. Somehow, the juxtaposition worked. Frey's short frame disappeared around the bar, but his hands could be seen grabbing for several bottles. There was a rattle, and in a moment his upper body appeared behind the bar. He was obviously standing on something.
I must say, the pay scale for evil is impressive.
Durand collapsed onto one of the cultured wood patio chairs.
Don't even joke about that.
Care for a drink?
I think I need one.
I'll make you my specialty.
Whatever. After today, I don't really care.
Quite the day.
Durand looked above and around him.
We can't stay here. The police could arrive any minute.
I'm not sure I agree with that assessment.
There was a tinkle of glasses.
How do you figure?
Well, this was Vegas's safe house, the operative word being safe. The place he would flee to if things went to shit, which would likely mean it's owned through a series of shell corporations that have no ties to him. No doubt lots of bribes were paid to keep it off the books. This is Thailand, after all.
What about the data trail for the choppers?
What trail?
That bootlegger OS they were running seemed less than legal. And don't overrate Interpol's influence in Thailand. We'll be long gone before your colleagues dig up this place. No, I think we're safe here for the time being. Safer by far than parading around the streets of Bangkok.
Durand considered this and finally leaned back into the patio chair.
Fine. But we need to get to the capital of Myanmar somehow.
Naypyidaw.
Right. That's where Vegas said the change agent was. That must be the elite black market those rumors mentioned.
Interesting city, Naypyidaw.
Durand looked at Frey in surprise.
You've been there?
No. No one's been there. I meant the city's history is interesting. I saw a documentary about it once. Half a century ago, the military junta decided its citizens were annoying. So they built a new capital city out in the middle of nowhere. Huge buildings, wide streets, but not many actual people. You can't just fly in there. It's locked down tight.
Nonetheless, we need to go there.
Frey poured two drinks into frosted martini glasses. Well, let's not eat boiled rice from the middle of the bowl, as the Thai people say.
Which means what exactly?
Frey walked from behind the bar.
It means let's not act without preparation.
Why it means that, I have no idea, but it does. He passed a glass to Durand, raising his own in toast.
To well-programmed escapes.
Durand clinked glasses, but then examined the bright red drink.
What is this?
I call this a blastocyst injection. Mekong whiskey and Krating Dang.
I suspect it's been responsible for more than a few pregnancies. Durand drank and winced at the strength of it. Frey got into one of the incredibly comfortable patio chairs.
Just look at that view.
Durand sat for several moments, lost in thought, staring out at the city. After a minute or so, he turned to see a wary expression on Frey's face.
What?
You had me going there for a bit back with the Luke Krung.
You didn't seriously think I was Wicks.
You were alarmingly convincing.
If I hadn't convinced Vegas, we'd both be dead right now, or arrested, which in my case is the same thing.
Frey was silent for a few moments.
You're really serious about going to Myanmar?
Yes, I'm serious. It's where the change agent is, and it's also where the real Marcus Wicks is.
And what will you do even if you reach Naypyidaw? It's not like the Huli Jing will have a Yelp listing. What's a Yelp listing?
Never mind. It was a thing. My point is that the Huli Jing are probably protected by the junta there.
Myanmar became a democracy decades ago.
There are a lot of democracies that aren't. The Myanmar military can countermand anything the civilian government does. That's why there's a multi-decade insurgency still going on there.
Then don't go. But I'm going, because I refuse to stay like this.
Things really could be worse for you, you know.
Oh, really? How? Has anyone stolen your body, Brian?
No, but neither has anyone spent weeks breaking me with torture. Make no mistake, a military junta is the real power in Burma, and the Huli Jing has probably paid them off. If they find you, they're liable to do terrible things. There's a reason there are 2 million Shan, Karen, and Hmong people in refugee camps along the border with Thailand. And what's more, you don't speak the language. You aren't exactly going to blend in. Do you even have a plan?
Durand pondered the question.
If I could get direct evidence of what the Huli Jing is doing and bring it out to the rest of the world, then perhaps international pressure could force action.
The world has been ignoring the situation in Myanmar for 50 years. What makes you think they're going to start noticing it now?
Durand gestured to his body.
Because this change agent will affect everyone on Earth. Like you said, this can't have been developed just to be used on me, and the Huli Jing is hiding it there in Myanmar where no one can see it.
Frey paused and then raised his eyebrows.
Scaring the bejesus out of the world. I suppose that might actually work. But if what you're looking for is evidence, why not just use yourself as evidence?
We have DNA proof that you're mostly Kenneth Durand.
I need to get changed back before I provide evidence.
Frey grunted.
I keep forgetting.
He took another sip of his drink.
Okay, so what constitutes evidence of this change agent?
A sample, I suppose.
Of the intact change agent, ready to use.
Durand nodded.
There's a major insurgency going on in Myanmar. Did I mention that?
You did.
Not thrilled about going.
I told you you don't have to.
Oh, but I think I do.
Frey grimaced.
The Thai police apparently followed you and me to the Luk Krung Clinic, which means I am now a known associate of possibly the most wanted man in the world.
Marcus Wicks.
Frey nodded.
So, I can't go back to where or who I was.
Or anywhere, really.
Durand sighed.
Shit.
I'm sorry I pulled you into all this, Brian.
You didn't do it. I did. Or, more accurately, Rod Desai did. Bastard hasn't even returned my messages. Probably in hiding, waiting for this to all blow over.
Durand brooded.
Frey took another sip of his drink. Besides, you and I had an agreement.
Even after all this, you still want to get edited?
Especially after all this. It's starting to sound like reinventing myself is the only viable option.
He looked approvingly at his drink.
And I can help us get over the border.
I thought you were clueless when it came to smuggling people over borders.
Normally, yes, but in this case, I have connections.
Your last connection wanted to kill us.
Tang did take my departure harder than I thought, but no, the Shan people and I get along famously.
The Shan people?
Indigenous hill tribes, Theravada Buddhists, 4 or 5 million of them spread across Laos, Thailand, and Burma. They're at war with the Burmese central government, as are the Hmong and the Karen people, and half a dozen smaller indigenous tribes. Seems they're all in the way of resource development projects.
And how do you know these Shan people?
I did freelance work for their resistance a few years back.
Durand couldn't mask his surprise.
Now, I wouldn't want to ruin your negative impression of me. I was paid,
and paid well. Black markets love wars.
I edited LOCOS07 and PSINE1 rice strains for the Shan to counteract Burmese government gene drives, some of which were developed by major biotech firms on the down low, in violation of UN treaties.
I'm familiar with gene drive weapons. I spent 8 years hunting bioterrorists.
Well then, you know how ugly shoving undesirable traits onto victim populations can be.
In this case, sabotaging rice to create famines. Destroy the food supply in a clandestine way, make it look like a blight, wrath of God, what have you. Nothing the media hasn't seen before. Better optics than landmines and airstrikes. It also drives tribes out of a whole region.
But the Shan hired black market genetic engineers of their own to create competing gene drives to keep their crops viable.
Genetic warfare. All genetics is warfare. And you still have contacts among these Shan?
Frey nodded. If they're still alive. I read that the government bought hunter-killer drones and set them loose in the jungles last year.
Lovely.
I'll reach out to the Shan later tonight. I've got a rather ponderous encrypted address book out there on the interwebs. I'll need to crack that open. I'm sure Vegas has some prepaid telecom equipment around here. He was always privacy-obsessed.
So you got your start with Vegas.
Frey looked wistful.
I lived here in Thailand for years, when I first left the States.
Then you speak Thai.
He laughed. No. When I say live, I mean like an American.
Why'd you leave the States?
Why'd you leave?
I asked first.
Frey shrugged.
I could see which way the wind was blowing. I got the sense they were going to start burning witches again, and big things were happening in my profession elsewhere.
Big things? Like children who've had compassion edited out of their genome.
Frey just gave him a look.
See, that's not a helpful attitude. You world policemen want to declare everything illegal, but in the final analysis, people will use every tool at their disposal to obtain advantage. You can't legislate morality.
You're not seriously arguing that Vegas had the right to create sterile, remorseless child soldiers.
Of course I'm not. I'm arguing that what can happen will happen, but that it's better that the research take place in the light of day rather than in the dark corners of the world.
They're creating a whole new subspecies of human. They're minting sociopaths is what they're doing, and they'll mingle into the general population.
And I'm certain the purchasers of these remorseless children will have buyer's remorse. Leading an army of sociopaths is incredibly dangerous. I might be a genetic engineer, but I think the demise of natural selection has been greatly exaggerated. Nature did not select for empathy and social bonds because nature was kind, but because those were survival advantages. Completely selfish, unfeeling people don't care for the greater good. They don't appreciate goals beyond themselves, and that limits them.
Durand stared. Then explain Wicks. He sure as hell seems to be succeeding.
Mark my words. Mother Nature has a hell of a backhand.
Soft jazz music suddenly started playing all around them. Durand and Frey both froze in alarm. Swirling mood lights illuminated the patio, creating a party lounge atmosphere. A beautiful young Thai woman in an ornate silk robe and sandals emerged from inside, walking confidently across the patio. She was stunning. Her smiling face fell when she noticed Durand and Frey, who were quite clearly not whom she had been expecting.
You're not Gino.
Frey sat up straight.
Sadly, we are not.
She checked her comm bracelet, tugged with long, polished nails at a virtual screen.
I got an alert that said Gino's chopper had arrived.
She looked up, businesslike.
He's not with you?
Durand shook his head. Frey shrugged casually.
Gino sent us ahead, told us to wait for him here. I'm sure he'll be along in a day or two.
She sighed in irritation.
He's not answering his phone.
He was quite busy when we left him. And you are? She looked irked, but said,
Gardenia.
Gardenia? What a lovely name.
I'm with Gino.
Of course. I'm an old associate of Gino's from back in the 20s.
I didn't think anyone knew Gino from that long ago. You must have some interesting stories.
None I can tell, unfortunately. She nodded.
I was going to take a swim.
Don't let us stop you. She shrugged and slipped off her robe, revealing her perfectly toned body in a bikini. She walked toward the water, kicked off her sandals, and dove in. Frey sighed. Such a lovely view out here. Durand finished his drink. I need to get some rest. You should do the same after you reach out to your hill tribe. He got up, examining the glass walls on the floor above. I'm going to find a bedroom. Looks like there are plenty. Frey raised his glass again. Durand followed a wide teakwood staircase upstairs into a long hallway. He wandered from door to door until he found what seemed to be a guest bedroom with a glass wall looking down on the pool area below and the broad sweep of the city lights. It appeared that all the rooms had glass walls. He wondered how people got privacy, or how they slept in. But he was too tired to think for long. Almost as soon as his head hit the pillow, and a very fine pillow it was, he fell asleep. Durand awoke suddenly in the middle of the night to commotion. It took him a moment to orient himself, but he finally recalled where he was, and as he looked around in the semi-darkness, a screen glowing on the wall pulsated in sync with rock music, a pounding beat. The text at the base of the pulsating colors read, Iggy Pop, Gardenia. He glanced down at the pool area through the plate glass and could see Vegas's Thai mistress and Frey dancing with reckless abandon, poolside, a champagne bottle in his hand. Durand put a pillow over his head and rolled back to sleep. Chapter 31. The dream was always the same. She is six again. Ayana's mother calls to her in their two-bedroom windowless mud-brick house. Ayana kneels at the hearth, baking kisra, the thin fermented bread of her childhood. She bakes on a sheet of tin pulled over the mouth of a cut-oil drum glowing with coals. The aroma of the bread tantalizes her, but she responds to the second call of her name, entering the front room to see a man in a crisp white taub and keffiyeh made of fine cotton standing in their doorway, not entering. For this would be haram, forbidden. Instead, he stands in the rubble-strewn street. Ayana's mother wears a dark taub wound about her body and her hair and speaks to him quietly. This, too, is a sin, but Ayana's father never came back from the war, the all-consuming, ever-expanding war that Ayana cannot understand. She imagines the war as a monster that eats people. People fear it. Men go to fight it and never return, or they come back mangled. The man holds a satellite phone. He also wears a glittering gold timepiece on his wrist that is the single most beautiful thing Ayana has ever seen. A blue SUV, coated in mud, is parked some ways behind him in the lane. The man says nothing to Ayana, merely looks her over while Ayana's mother and brothers stand nearby. Eventually, the man nods, and Ayana's mother leans down to her. Her mother's face is always blurry in the dream. Ayana can no longer recall her mother's face.
Go with this man now. Do as he says, and be a good girl.
The man takes Ayana's hand, and Ayana looks back again, bewildered, as she is pulled away, out the door, and her mother's eyes watch her go from the darkness of their hovel. Sadness? Relief? What is the expression on her mother's face? Ayana would give anything to know now. Maybe that is the reason for the dream. Her brothers look on, for once not teasing. But the beautiful timepiece is there, right next to her face, wrapped around the man's thick, hairy wrist. She reaches to touch the watch face, and the man smacks her hand away. She begins to cry. Inspector Ayanna Marcotte woke from the dream as she always did, crying. She fumbled for the light on the hotel nightstand, and then grabbed the medallion on a silver chain she knew was there. She looked upon the dull bronze medallion beneath the light. A St. Anne medal, the patron saint of the childless. She had found it in the envelope of her foster mother's personal things after her adoptive mother passed away in the hospital. Marcotte had never known that her foster mother wore it. Not until that day. How long had her foster mother prayed for a child? How long had Marcotte prayed for a mother? What did it mean that Saint Anne was also revered in Islam? In the Quran, she was known as Hannah. Different religions, but the same prayer. Marcotte sat up and wiped her face, collected herself. She looked down at the second medallion she had since added to her foster mother's silver chain. Saint Peter Claver, the patron saint to slaves. It steadied her. She looked up at the window in the sunlight rising above Bangkok. Then she grabbed her LFP glasses from the charger and put them on. The news feeds were on fire. The story was everywhere. 236 dead. 31 of the victims Thai police, among them members of the country's most elite anti-terror unit. Prominent civilians from around the world dead. Children dead. Every member of the Luk Krung, dead. And everywhere in the feeds, not the face of Marcus Wicks, but instead the face of the young suited man the media had dubbed the Angel of Death. Somehow, clinic surveillance camera imagery of the Huli Jing assassin had leaked. The same thing Marcotte had fought in the street had its face at the top of every media feed. His touch meant death. It wasn't a he. It was an it. She remembered its unliving eyes. Headlines screamed that his skin oozed poison. There was a sharp knock on her door. She walked wearily to the peephole. Her skin was still raw from the decontamination chemicals and harsh brushes they'd used to scrub off the first layer of her skin. The biohazard team had incinerated her tactical vest, her clothing. Her head was bald after they'd shaved off every lock of hair. She was clean, alive. She peered through the opening and saw Sergeant Michael Yi Ji Chang with several grim-faced Thai men in suits, detectives, no doubt. Marcotte closed her robe and opened the door. Yi nodded.
Morning, Inspector. No doubt you've seen the news.
She nodded back.
General Prem's been sacked. They want us out of the country by nightfall.
She nodded again.
I'll come and collect you when you're ready.
He waited for a response, but finally shrugged and moved away.
Sergeant.
Yi turned.
Wicks committed this atrocity to stop us. We do not stop. Do you understand? We pursue him. He will go to ground somewhere, and when he does, I want him to hear our hounds on his trail.
Yi nodded, looking relieved, and then headed for the elevators with the Thai detectives close behind. Chapter 32. Well after dawn, Kenneth Durand lay staring at the view of downtown Bangkok through his feet. The glass wall made it seem as though he was lying on a ledge overlooking Bhumibol Bridge with its golden, pointed spires. What troubled him most was that he hadn't thought of his wife and daughter the moment he awoke. Instead, he'd stared out at the city just grateful to be alive. What he should have been grateful for was his chance to continue, to keep striving to get back to himself. His growing comfort in this form angered him. A knock on the bedroom door interrupted his troubled thoughts. The knock was followed immediately by Brian Frey walking in and jumping up to sit on the edge of the large bed.
"Sorry to pester you, but the world has apparently not stopped turning, and there's news you need to see."
Frey made inscrutable gestures above a new bracelet he wore, causing LFP projectors to descend from pods in the ceiling. These began shining content into Duran's retinas. A virtual 200-inch video screen appeared, superimposed before the view of Bangkok. Acoustic beams brought sound. The screen displayed news feeds and audio, all in Thai, but with a gesture, Frey converted it to English. Harrowing, scrolling headlines rolled past beneath grim-faced news reporters. "Pattaya City Massacre, over 200 dead. General Prem resigns in disgrace." Duran sat up.
"What the hell?"
Frey watched the images.
"After we escaped, it seems Wicks wasn't content to let his people fall into the hands of the police. Either that, or he'd hoped to eliminate you."
Duran felt a wave of horror sweep over him.
"Those children."
Frey muted the video.
"Police, children, the clients, and Mr. Vegas, along with his Luke Krung."
"Jesus." Duran's breathing increased, and he could feel his tattoos surfacing all over him. He sat shirtless before a screen filled with sickening headlines. Headlines he had caused.
"We killed them all."
"No, don't say that." Frey pointed at the screen, at a crystal-clear surveillance image that was in heavy rotation on all the feeds. The Angel of Death.
"He killed them, a man dripping in nerve toxins. That's who we need to talk about."
Frey froze the image with a gesture. Durand frowned at the screen.
"Nerve toxins? You remember Vegas was afraid of Wicks's right-hand man, the man he called Otto?"
Duran nodded.
"That little Einstein girl, she cried at the mention of Otto. She called him the Mirror Man. Do you remember her saying that?"
"Yes."
"I thought it was strange for her to use such a mystical name, especially because she was so brilliant."
"She was still just a child." Duran studied the face of the killer.
"I think I've met this man before. In Singapore." "You met the Angel of Death?"
"I'll remember those eyes for the rest of my life. Dead eyes. I recognize some of the face. He's changed, but not entirely." Duran turned to Frey.
"This was the man who injected me. I'm certain of it."
Frey pondered something.
"It's making more and more sense. He's immune to biotoxins."
Frey popped a pill from a half-empty blister pack.
"What are you taking?"
"I printed up a batch of nootropics. Improves brain function. It's making things clearer. Follow me on this." Frey pointed.
"This is indeed Wicks's right hand.
Do you get it? Right hand?" Duran just stared.
"He's an enantiomorph."
Duran kept staring.
"Nearer life. That's why he isn't affected by biotoxins. He wouldn't be affected by human viruses or parasites or diseases either, because he is the opposite of life."
"I don't understand." Frey snapped his fingers, searching for words.
"Chirality, handedness. Molecules like amino and nucleic acids have a handedness. Not literally hands, but orientations of a molecule's atoms. They can be reversed from left to right to left. They could have the same chemical formula, but be mirror images of each other, and thus have different interactions, even though they are technically the same compounds."
"So you think this man is an opposite?"
All complex organisms on Earth are comprised of left or levo amino acids. Nobody is entirely sure why that is, but that's the way life evolved. Frey pointed at the screen.
I think the Huli Jing created an opposite form of life.
Why?
That's the question, isn't it?
Durand looked again at the killer's face. I can't describe it, but there was something about him that was terrifying. It's like he was alive, but shouldn't have been.
Frey nodded to himself, riding the nootropics.
Fascinating. I would have guessed it would be no different from a racemic mixture.
He looked up.
Which is a mixture of both left and right-handed enantiomers.
He held up a finger.
But perhaps some aspect of mirror life evokes an evolved revulsion in us, some survival instinct that is repelled by its presence. This Otto, anti-person, he would have no connection to any other living thing on Earth. He wouldn't even be able to digest normal food.
It can't have been a coincidence that he was there. He must have followed me.
Frey looked grim once more. It wasn't a coincidence. Radea Desai is also dead.
Durand snapped a look at Frey.
Dead?
Yes. Gruesomely, too. The news said it was a gang killing, but I think it was Otto looking for you.
Durand lowered his head into his hands.
I've gotten all these people killed.
No. Frey pointed at the screen. It is this person, or this anti-person, who's done this. It's Marcus Wicks who's done this, not you.
I caused it to happen.
You Deegans are always so willing to accept guilt. You were just trying to survive, Ken.
Durand gestured to the image of Otto on the screen.
He was there because of me. All those people died because he had come there to kill me.
And what about the police? What were the police doing there?
I don't know.
Durand lowered his head into his hands again.
I don't know.
Durand looked up.
And what does it matter if this man is mirror life or just a killer? All it shows is how twisted the Huli Jing are to create this abomination.
Frey crawled toward Durand across the bed.
Ah, that's where you're wrong, my friend.
I think there might be a link between your transformation and this Otto. Look, he poked the trefoil knot tattoo still visible on Durand's arm.
Why is the Huli Jing lab symbol a trefoil?
Durand examined the tattoo, the single looping line. Frey tapped it.
These are Wix's tattoos.
Tattoos are personal things.
We've been wasting an incredible source of intelligence about Wix that's woven right into your skin.
Unless he was on a bender when he got these, he didn't choose them by chance.
Durand looked down at his arm again.
Frey jabbed a tattoo.
A trefoil is significant.
I don't know why it didn't occur to me before.
A trefoil knot is the simplest chiral knot in existence, meaning it is not identical to its mirror image, and DNA trefoils have major implications in intramolecular synapses of English.
English, please, Brian.
Right. That's the nootropics talking.
He stood on the bed examining Durand's tattoo array, studying them like a psychic reading a palm.
What I'm saying is that I think the trefoil holds the key to the change agent's morphology.
On Durand's blank look, he explained,
its structure.
Durand nodded.
Okay.
But there's more.
Frey pointed at the screen.
What do you see on Otto there, on his neck?
Do you see it?
He zoomed the image in.
Durand saw a tattoo of a gray, white, and gold butterfly on the man's neck. There were other tattoos, but the butterfly was most prominent.
Just like yours, probably not visible unless the blood's up, like yours is now. But
Frey stretched the skin over Durand's butterfly, comparing it to the tattoo on the screen.
He and Wicks got matching tattoos.
Check it out.
Same species and everything.
But that doesn't tell us what it means.
Frey poked him.
Maybe it does. Hu Lijing, if we bothered to read up on our mythology, is a shape-shifting mythological being, a mischievous spirit that can take any form.
Yes, I know. I sat through a briefing on the Hu Lijing the day I got injected. Interpol thought the name meant Wix's organization wanted to remain hidden.
Clearly, the name and the tattoo was chosen for its literal meaning.
He tapped his finger on Duran's butterfly tattoo again.
And I think this butterfly was as well.
What do butterflies undergo?
Metamorphosis.
Right, metamorphosis, changing from a caterpillar into its final form. Do you know something interesting about caterpillars and butterflies that not a lot of people realize?
What?
A caterpillar and its butterfly have the same genetic sequence.
Frey pounded his fist into his hand.
Same exact DNA and completely different forms. How is that possible?
Durand realized he'd never known that, and it did seem puzzling.
Epigenetics. Gene expression. Turning genes on and off. That's what happens during the butterfly's metamorphosis. It builds a chrysalis and secretes chemicals that cause it to fall into a comatose state as its body changes.
Like my coma, after they injected me.
Frey nodded.
I think that's what the Hu Lijing discovered. Not only how to edit DNA, but how to turn genes on and off on demand, not simply write them into the chain.
After all, computer code doesn't do anything unless you execute it. He stabbed at Duran's butterfly tattoo.
I think this was the butterfly species that helped them figure it out, and why Wix and Otto wear it as a tattoo. Archon Apollinus, the false Apollo.
What did you just say?
Frey turned to him.
Archon Apollo, no, the other name.
False Apollo.
Durand got to his feet and paced.
Christ.
He rubbed his hands over his bald, tattooed scalp.
Get rid of his damn face, please.
Oh, sorry.
With a gesture, the television screen blinked out of existence. Frey watched Durand.
What's up?
False Apollo. Is that really this butterfly's name?
I checked it this morning. I've been busy. Talk to me.
I worked on an anti-bioterror team back in the 30s, Naval Intelligence. We were searching for nihilistic terrorist groups, or brilliant idiots, people who might accidentally or purposely create genetic weapons that could wipe out humanity, either directly or by crippling our ecosystems.
So what about this false Apollo?
They briefed all the teams on it. False Apollo. It was the name of a multi-billion-dollar illicit biodefense project. It was a big deal. They shut it down.
It was a military project?
It was unclear who was running it. Government, industry, no one knew. It spanned borders.
What was False Apollo's purpose?
To create a universal defense against an extinction-level pathogen.
In other words, mirror life. Durand shrugged.
I don't know. Like I said, they shut False Apollo down. I never saw it. Maybe parts of it got out into the world. We were warned to keep a lookout.
Well, fuck me.
Frey pondered the implications.
The name fits. Apollo was the Greek god of music, healing, and light, but he was also the god of plagues.
Frey looked up.
So, the Hu Lijing might be remnants of a rogue biodefense project?
Durand paced.
No wonder they had so many connections. We've got to get moving.
Frey nodded.
Gardenia and I were able to transact some business last night.
Durand gave him an exasperated look.
I'm not interested in your...
Not that sort of business. I mean business.
She was more than a little concerned when she learned of Vegas's demise, and she was eager to exchange the bot we had for Biocoin. She might be heading to her home village to lie low for a while.
Can we trust her? We're going to have to trust her. Vegas trusted her, and she was more than helpful.
Look.
Frey held up a gleaming piece of obsidian etched with a gold stylized aircraft logo.
She showed me where he kept his credit fobs.
What is that?
Durand took it. A hideously expensive, zero-memory, on-demand, autonomous electric jet service. Jet Black. This will bring us a lot closer to Myanmar.
We won't be able to get near an airport.
We won't have to. Vertical takeoff and landing. We can use the helipad outside.
Costs a goddamn fortune, but it's not our money.
He took the credit fob back.
More importantly, I got in touch with my Shan contact last night.
They're still alive, and they said they would agree to smuggle us over the border and through the Burmese highlands. Although it's going to cost us.
Durand started to get dressed.
How much?
$500,000. Pretty much everything we had.
How do you know these Shan people of yours aren't going to just kill us?
Their payment is contingent on our safe arrival in Naypyidaw. With Gardenia's help, I converted all our cash into a single encrypted wallet and gave the Shan a down payment of $100,000. They get the balance when we arrive safely.
They could torture the code out of you.
They'd have no reason to. They're making the trip anyway, and I've helped them a great deal in the past, which is the only reason Shan 938 agreed to take us.
Shan 938, that's the name of your contact?
It's the only name I was ever given. I've never met any of them in person.
Durand narrowed his eyes.
How do you know these aren't just criminals or scammers?
Because they've paid me considerably more than this over the years for genetic editing of their crops. And this account holder had the encryption keys and digital signature to prove they are who they say. You must understand, these Shan are a spiritual people, Buddhists. The central government keeps trying to kill them, and they just want to be left alone. They're not criminals.
What do they know about us?
I told them you and I need to get to the capital of Myanmar, and if the central government knew what we planned on doing there, they'd probably try to kill us.
And they didn't ask what we'll be doing?
Frey shook his head.
You conducted this exchange over an encrypted line, I hope.
Now I'm insulted.
I break the law for a living.
What route will we be taking?
They didn't say what route we'd be taking. Operational security. They'll want to be certain we're not working with the Tatmadaw first, of course. All they gave me was GPS coordinates and a date and time to meet. 3 o'clock this afternoon.
Durand shot a concerned look Frey's way.
This afternoon? That's cutting it close, isn't it? What is that, 400 miles away?
Yes, but we'll have a jet. Shan 938 said if we arrive in anything else or with anyone else, we'll be shot out of the sky.
Durand just stared at Frey.
What time did you get up this morning?
I didn't sleep.
Frey brought up a 3-dimensional satellite map of the Thai-Burmese border region, projecting it where the video screen was. The entire glass wall was replaced by an aerial view of 100 square miles of jungle-choked mountains and brown, snaking rivers. A yellow dot highlighted a mountain clearing 15 kilometers from the Burmese border.
That's where they wanted to meet.
Durand pointed at the bracelet Frey was using to control the video screen.
Where'd you get the comm bracelet?
Frey went into the hallway and came back with a box brimming with dozens of phablets, bracelets, circlets, and LFP glasses. He dumped them on the bed.
Like I said, Tang liked his privacy.
These are all prepaid, bought by surrogates from all over Thailand. He even kept receipts. Frey smirked.
You know what they say, when privacy is criminalized, only criminals will have privacy.
Durand poked through the pile.
I'm not who you think I am, Brian. I'm no more a fan of total surveillance than you are.
He grabbed a pair of LFP glasses and looked back up at the map projected over the glass wall.
These Shan people of yours, you're confident they can smuggle us to the capital? They smuggle everything. The Burmese military has declared foreign biofacturing tools and software illegal. The resistance brings in high-tech equipment, weapons, money. Durand turned the mountainous map model this way and that. It looked like seriously rugged terrain. You said the central government deployed deep maneuver weapons in this region? Frey gave him a blank stare. Autonomous drones, robotic weapons.
Oh, right, last year. It's a regular arms bazaar out there.
Durand grunted. Those might be a problem. The worse ones generate their own energy, grow their own algae biofuels from decomposing plant matter. They can remain in the field for months, sometimes years, waiting.
Why am I not surprised you know about this sort of thing?
I didn't say I approved of them, I just know about them. He looked back at the map. Let's summon this jet black of yours. They waited on the patio for nearly an hour, but finally they heard the hissing sound of an approaching jet. The Lilium electric jet was sleeker than the Ehang chopper, predictably black, with wings that extended from the rear of a lozenge-shaped cabin and smaller ducted electric fans up front. A line of dozens more small ducted fan jets ran the entire length of both wings. Apparently, it utilized an array of massively redundant smaller jet engines instead of a few big ones. The aircraft rose above the railing from below, rotated, and settled with uncanny accuracy in the center of the helipad. Its jets wound down while a voice called out loudly, "Stand clear! Stand clear! Stand clear!" Red lights flashed. One of the engines fell silent. The tinted gullwing doors opened, as did a luggage compartment. "Call me Jet Black. Welcome." Durand watched with some consternation as Frey dragged two large duffel bags across the pavement. He struggled to heave them into the jet's cargo bay.
"What's all that?"
"If you're concerned about theft, let me remind you that the former owner was a criminal, so it's already stolen. I'm just moving it."
Durand shook his head and climbed into the passenger compartment. Again, a two-seater, it was even more finely appointed than Vegas's fleet of Ehangs. The seats looked to have been handmade with real organic leather. Frey followed a moment later. As he sat down, the synthetic voice spoke. "Aircraft overloaded by 27 kilograms. Please remove at least 27 kilograms of weight."
"Damn it."
Durand got out before Frey could beat him to it. He opened the cargo hatch and pulled out the first duffel bag. It was unwieldy. He unzipped it.
"What the hell is in here?"
Durand pulled out what looked like a portable pharmaceutical printer. Frey came up alongside him.
"The Shan could make good use of that. Korean-made. It's high-quality gear, and it'll only be confiscated by the police if it remains here."
Durand pulled out a dozen bottles of expensive-looking liquor, packages of vaping supplies. He tossed them onto the patio, then shoved the half-empty duffel bag back into the cargo compartment. They both climbed back in and buckled up in frosty silence. Frey finally said,
"That wasn't all for me, you know. There are gift protocols in Asian society that one should try to follow.
$500,000 makes a damn nice gift."
"Say Jet Black and tell me your desired destination."
AR maps and gauges appeared in front of them both. Frey began to manipulate the map to enter his destination coordinates. Durand stopped him.
"Don't enter the coordinates now. Plug in a popular destination nearby. A tourist spot would be perfect."
"I've got the GPS coordinates right here."
"If anyone's tracking us, we don't need to give them hours to prepare a reception committee. Give it a destination that isn't going to set off any red flags, and we'll change it at the last minute when we get close."
"I suppose I should listen to a man who spies on people for a living."
Frey spoke to the AI.
"Jet Black, fly us to
Chiang Mai Airport, please.
Why do you say please to these things?
Because it's polite, that's why.
They sell that information to advertisers.
They sell the fact that I'm polite to machines.
They sell the fact that you're susceptible to technical animism.
So what if I am?
Tell me that after your machines start to sound wounded if you don't buy something. The electric duct fans hissed to life, and a synthetic voice spoke. Your journey to Chiang Mai International Airport is estimated at 2 hours and 13 minutes. Please prepare for liftoff, and feel free to call my name if you need anything while we are en route. Chapter 33. The Lilium electric jet was smooth and quiet. They cruised along at 3,000 meters altitude, going several hundred kilometers per hour. Durand reclined, consumed with his own thoughts, while Frey snored, sound asleep just minutes after takeoff. Durand watched the mirrored office towers of Bangkok CBD recede quickly behind them. Before long, they soared past the last residential block and golf course and set out over a patchwork of long rectangular rice fields. Durand could see orange robotic farm machinery in the shallow rice paddies. The wide central plain of Thailand spread out before him, traced by glittering rivers and dotted with golden temples. Despite his deep concerns over what lay ahead, Durand found himself thinking about how much his daughter Mia would have loved this flight. He suddenly felt very homesick, but also relieved to feel that again. He tried to keep his focus on who he was. He was Kenneth Durand. Examining his arms, he was comforted to see that his tattoos had hidden themselves again. They seemed to be appearing more and more lately. As the Lilium jet traveled north, the rivers multiplied and hillocks appeared in the plains, until green jungle foothills drew in from either side. Mountainous regions were barely visible beyond the humid haze. The occasional gleaming golden pagoda caught the sun's light. Whitewashed stupas and the stepped roofs of temples mixed in with office buildings and shopping malls. The little jet raced northward for hours until around midday a large city came into view ahead. The AR mapping system labeled it Chiang Mai, with cultural markers popping up like mushrooms. Soft chimes sounded. I hope you're enjoying your flight. We've begun our descent to Chiang Mai International Airport Autonomous Transport Terminal and should be on the ground within 10 minutes. Durand nudged the snoring Frey as the jet began to descend. Frey snapped alert.
Yes, what is it?
Time to enter your coordinates.
Chiang Mai already?
Yes.
Damn. I want to bring this seat with us. Let me sleep for just a few more minutes.
Durand elbowed Frey sharply in the ribs. Up. Key in the coordinates. Frey sighed and sat up. He manipulated a few invisible objects in his glasses.
Jet Black,
how can I help you?
Substitute new destination.
A larger map appeared before them. Surcharges may apply. Where would you like to go?
Travel to these GPS coordinates. 19 degrees, 35 minutes, 26.18 seconds north latitude, and 98 degrees, 0 minutes, 54.96 seconds east longitude. Desired arrival time, 3 p.m. local.
Please wait. After a few moments, the onboard systems calculated their path and displayed a map into their retinas. The synthetic voice said, Your selected destination lies inside a safety advisory zone. Additional insurance charges will be 400% of the standard rate. Do you accept? Please indicate.
Frey raised an eyebrow.
Just an extra $42,000 in insurance? Why not? I don't think Vegas will mind.
He clicked the yes button, hovering in midair. A rerouting surcharge of 25% also applies. Do you accept? Frey gritted his teeth and clicked yes. Thank you. Estimated arrival time at new destination, 3 p.m., local time. Enjoy your flight. They curved left, away from Chiang Mai, heading up toward the mountains to the northwest. The weather was clear as the jet sailed over jungle-filled ravines, waterfalls, and rapids. Treetops raced past the viewports at their feet, and suddenly a golden stupa dome appeared, glittering in the sunlight, but then gone as they raced still upward past more jungle. When they crested the first mountain, a vast terrain of rugged jungle wilderness stretched out before them. Rainstorms were visible in the far distance, with flashes of lightning and dark clouds and shadows, but here it was still clear. Steam rose from various pockets in the dense forests below. Durand scanned the horizon. It was becoming clear how vast this jungle was. Frey grimaced.
Why do I get the feeling we're not dressed properly for this?
Durand looked down at their business casual clothes and loafers. We'll deal with it. At least we'll be the best-dressed people in the Resistance. They soared within 50 meters of the highest ridge. A golden Buddha statue passed below inside a tiled, peaked roof at the summit. Beyond it, the land fell out beneath them. Ahead, tall peaks still loomed. Their destination appeared in AR as a glowing green dot beamed into their eyes. They were going in. The jet's engines decreased. Jet Black here. I hope you're enjoying your flight. We're beginning our descent to coordinates 19 degrees, 35 minutes, 26.18 seconds, north latitude, and 98 degrees, 0 minutes, 54.96 seconds, east longitude. Please prepare for landing. The jet glided downward, rocking in minor turbulence. Frey glanced at the clock. Look at that, 2:59 p.m. See? That's what I like about machines, precision. Tell me that when we're facing killer drones. The jet rocked a bit more before it entered a sloping valley surrounded on all sides by much higher jungle peaks. They turned, spiraling down toward the only clearing in sight. It was ringed by tangled brush and short broadleaf trees. There were no structures or people in sight. The jet's forward thrusters kicked in, and they went into a hover just above the landing zone. The grass billowed away from the jet wash. The synthetic voice said, "There is no standardized landing pad here. In order to land, do you agree to accept any and all liability?"